These are the Target Files, taking a 21st century look back at the 20th century adventures of the Doctor in novelization and audiobook form, looking through the eyes of adulthood at our childhood memories. After all, a great Time Lord once said, there's no point in being grown up if you can't be childish some of the time.
Hello there, this is the Target Files with episode 62. This is Alex in Exeter, and we're discussing Doctor Who, The Ark, written by Paul Erickson, with the audiobook read by Peter Purvis.
Hi, this is Mike in Swansea.
So, bit of an interesting one here, Mike, I thought. A lot of sort of interesting themes. What did you think of it?
Seen it as a TV story, I think, only the once. Caught up with the odd few episodes. Didn't have time to rewatch it all again. Generally, overall, quite an intriguing book, really. Quite a few good strengths, a few little weaknesses I'll mention a bit later into the podcast. But overall, enjoyable, and we have the new Peter Purvis audiobook, and as ever, he's a very in-depth, engaging reader.
I think the audiobooks are not bad audiobook, actually. He's got Peter Purvis doing a very good reading. I think he's William Hartnell impersonation is so good. It's really very close, because obviously worked a lot with him and got to know him. And I did get the DVD a couple of days back and watched the episodes, and they're very good, but I think what they were trying to do was maybe a bit too much for what they could do at the time. And listening to the commentary on the DVD, I think that is the main feeling, that the script was a very good script, but they sort of couldn't really do as much as they wanted to do.
Yes, do you think the hopes for the scale in the episodes are reintroduced in the book by Erickson, of course, the man who did write the TV script as well originally?
I think the actual aliens are a bit more scarier in the book than they are in the TV episode, because if you've ever seen the TV episodes, you know what they are, basically a ping pong on a stick.
One-eyed, cycloptic-looking beast, aren't they, the monoid?
Yeah, they're like that. And I think it was quite interesting what the director of this said. He was actually trying to come up with some early form of merchandising. He wanted a new alien that the children could basically get into and maybe make merchandise for. It didn't really work, unfortunately.
So they weren't going around turning their mothers' or fathers' mops upside down and sticking an eyeball on it?
Unfortunately not. I know, we've seen this with other Doctor Who aliens that haven't really worked in the past, you know, and it sort of seems to be only be able to work with two, I think, you know, the Cybermen and the Daleks, really.
Yeah, shall we explain a little bit of the synopsis for the listeners, Al? The Ark, self-explanatory in a title. The Earth is in a bit of trouble, and they're looking to move species away from our planet, aren't they, on a giant spaceship?
Yeah, basically, that's the main point, and it's like, you know, survival, and, you know, they're trying to keep their race alive by having this big Ark full of their last of each race. And unfortunately, when the Doctor and Dodo and Stephen arrive on this sort of planet, they think Earth, unfortunately, infect half the colony. It sort of becomes the, you know, survival of the species.
Yes, parallels with Capaldi's season finale, the giant selection of worlds on a spaceship.
Yeah, definitely. I think there is some elements to that, because you've got different, like with that, you had different levels, you know, going for a different time sort of thing. And I think there's sort of the same level parallels in this, you know, the really well looked after alien creatures have all the best bits, and the ones that are sort of frozen don't, really.
Yes, and as you said, a little bit confined in the TV studio, Al.
Yeah, I think so, because it does look a little bit dated. I watched the DVD, and though it's quite a quality picture, the sound did sound a little bit hissy in some points.
Quite engaging from the start, really, with Peter Purves' performance. Did you feel engaged throughout the book, Al? Did he possibly let your mind wander off at certain points like I did? Was it engaging enough throughout?
I would say I was engaged for most of it, but I did start wondering due to the fact it's like 8 particular chapters in the order book, and they're about, again, I've had the normal ghost-like problem you had a few books back where the chunks are so big, but you do sort of lose concentration by the end.
Yeah, so quite a few characters again in this story. Al, the humans to begin with, and then we have the giant sort of twist later on when they return to the planet many centuries later.
There's a lot of characters, and that's a really nice sort of twist by half. It's about halfway in the book, and it's about at the end of episode 2 in the episodes. And I think it does work, that whole twist, because it feels different, because, you know, we always have conclusions these days in like a 1 episode or 2 where at the end of this, I won't, you know, spoil it quite, it seems to be leading up to the next series. It sort of will be rather nice to watch these series when we get the Blu-ray box sets eventually and see how they all connect. I think it does work.
Yes, it's a very interesting turn within the story, isn't it? You know, the idea of the Ark, the idea of the cold virus coming in.
Oh, yeah, I think that's a very clever element. I think the script is a lot better than what actually you see on screen, based, and that's why I think the audiobook's very good. Where it's, you know, on screen time slightly lets it down, I think, sometimes. And I think it's very good otherwise.
Yeah, I want to talk about the Doctor's characterisation. In particular, his treatment of Dodo. I did find it quite a bit patronising. He's really quite critical of her throughout, isn't he? Particularly, it's a running theme, her use of the English language he criticises.
It's both him and Stephen, Peter Burse's character, they both do it to her. And, well, the Doctor does it more, you know, he's very annoyed with her not blowing her nose properly and, you know, calls her Dorothea, which is slightly patronizing, because he likes to be called Dodo, and that's her name. So there's lots of little bits through the episodes, I think, what are not the greatest for the Doctor, you know, the William Hartnell Doctor, when it comes to women, unfortunately.
Yes, as we saw with the, well, taken lightheartedly, but it also got criticism in Twice Upon a Time.
Yeah, there was lots of bits, what, you know, obviously what they looked at these old episodes and saw how he was, unfortunately, and there was the great bits, what I thought were, you know, a bit annoying for people in Twice Upon a Time. I think it would be very interesting to see how they deal with those in the audiobook of Twice Upon a Time, what's coming out.
Yes, our Paul Cornell release coming in the next few months as a Target novelisation, the new ones, folks. Glad you mentioned Stephen, Al, because he is quite patronising in the very first scene towards Dodo as well, because she's quite confident and convinced this is a, I think it's Whipsnade Zoo, isn't it, you know, in England. She believes they've materialised there.
Yeah, this is the whole, you know, she comes out of the TARDIS and she's very confident, and about, not even a minute, I'd say, Stephen sort of slaps her down, going, oh, you don't know where you've never been out, you know, it might not be Earth, it might be this, you know. So it's sort of trying to break her confidence down, and, you know, the Doctor does it to her as well, I think, pretty quickly afterwards. So, and I think there's some, I remember he's never given the character names, but I think there's also some really interesting female characters with the alien race, and I think they're treated the same, really. So I don't think women come over very well in these episodes, unfortunately. Clearly it was meant to be 66 when this came out, so you think things would be slightly changing by then.
Yeah, certainly from Susan, although we have mentioned in the past Barbara was a very strong character from the word go, really.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, see. I think that's the thing with Dodo, because, you know, they've had 2 really strong women characters, and then I think they started going into typecast, you know, like they did for a while with Doctor Who, we got 2 people like Liz Shaw and Sarah Jane. I think for a while there you got very screamy Doctor companions.
The sexism, if it is that, reached the peak for me when the Doctor dismisses her and says, oh, I could explain time travel to you, but you wouldn't understand it.
Yeah, there's that really, you know, what you think she would understand it, because she's quite educated by the looks of it, and, you know, she's from our time, I think she would, and he's just, you know, slapping her down immediately.
There are positive aspects to Peter Purves's portrayal, as we said. I think he's really got the Hartnell twinkle in this story, isn't he? I mean, I think elsewhere, a few years back, we reviewed the audiobook of The Massacre, and that's a very, very sort of serious story. You know, Hartnell's Doctor's very serious and doesn't really have the lightness of touch in that one. He brings the sort of engaging humorous nature of the First Doctor into this audiobook more than he did in that one.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the performances, because he's done a few now, Peter Purvis says, and the one in The Massacre was quite dark, and the Doctor trying to survive France. But this one is quite, I am in control, I can be relaxed. And I was comparing, which I shouldn't really do, I was comparing the voices with William Hartnell and Peter Purvis, and they weren't that far off, to be honest.
One thing we certainly need to talk about, stifling our giggles before we recorded today, the old use of language, shall we say, from Mr. Paul Erickson. Do you want to reveal the word he described?
It's very hilarious, you know. There's a lot of nice wording in this, and I think it's quite funny the way we take it. So what was the word?
To describe the Doctor making an exclamation, really, but the Doctor notices in an early scene there's a tiger around, and he makes a shh noise to try and quieten it down, and it's all very lovely described as the tiger being a bit more like a cat and just sort of moving up against their legs to mark its territory. And the actual words are, shh, the Doctor ejaculated. Now, being a bit juvenile, I presume, first of all, not knowing Paul Erickson's background, that he might have been a sort of 80s fanboy of that variety who'd written this adaptation and decided to stick it in as a bit of a joke. But it was actually his TV script, and he was coming towards the end of his life in his late 60s when this book was published in 87, so it is the old, more exclaiming sort of representation of the word, I think, Al, but it's used again, isn't it, in reference to moments featuring Dodo and Stephen, so it certainly had me stifling a few, yes, I know, folks, juvenile giggles throughout.
Yeah, it's a very fun use of the word, and I just wonder, looking at it now, is it something what a slightly slack editor back then didn't proofread it properly and just it slipped through.
Almost famously in Delta and the Bannerman, when they left out the R from the word peering over the shelf, the Sylvester McCoy Doctor.
So he was peeing over the shelf.
Well,
I think sometimes the target books haven't been proofread before they hit the print, I think, so we do get these lovely little errors sometimes.
I fear there was so much ejaculation in this book that if I owned the paperback copy, the pages might be stuck together. Sorry.
No, I know what you mean.
I couldn't resist it.
It's a word that seems to use an awful lot in it. I have the feeling we're not the only one. I think there was a few edits would know what Peter Purvis is like.
And it does take you out of a pretty nicely written scene, doesn't it? The menace of the tiger, first of all, approaching them, and all of a sudden it's almost had the tiger catnip and it's very chilled out.
Yeah, I think it does, unfortunately, because that's those sort of first scenes when on that jungle space, well, you know, it's like part of the ship, isn't it? They are quite tense, some of those bits with the animals, and then it does take the tension out of the way it's written, unfortunately.
Absolutely, Al. And we also have various other animals on the planet. A famous scene of an elephant who actually behaved itself, which was before a more famous scene when Peter Purvis became a children's TV presenter in the UK on a show called Blue Peter a few years after, and there's a rather famous clip you can find online from 1969 with an elephant in a live studio making a bit of a mess of the studio floor and the presenters slipping all over the place.
Unfortunately, it didn't behave itself, that elephant.
But it's well recommended, folks. Very funny.
It's hilarious. It is hilarious still for this day.
On various blooper shows down the years. But the elephant itself, Al, was called back to in Thin Ice last year. We had the cliffhanger at the end of Smileden. We're going into Victorian London on the Frozen Thames, and the elephant was on there.
Yeah, that was a really, really nice shot in Thin Ice, and you know, you'd wish the Doctor got a bit more involved with the elephant. We just sort of saw it, because apparently there was an actual elephant on the Thames when it froze in real life, apparently.
On towards the story's ending, how do you feel things were wrapped up?
Well, this is interesting, because when I was watching and listening to it, I thought, you know, this is quite good. It all neatly comes together. And then you've got that really weird bit at the end. I don't know if it's still in the audiobook, I think it is, where they just land in the TARDIS and it's all right. And then the sort of Doctor's going, no, it's not all right. And it sort of ends there. And you're thinking, well, hang on, is this... Obviously, because when it was on TV, it goes directly into the next story. And then you're thinking, this is a bit rushed edit. I don't know if I quite like it.
A lot of the Hartnell stories did have a lead-in, though, to the next one.
I think because we're just not used to it, and I think that's what we were getting back used to last year with Peter... Peter Capaldi's Doctor Who episode, but they all went into one, didn't they, last year? And I think we're just not used to it any longer. I think it adds more to the story if we'd seen probably the next one, I think. So, what do we think of the book, the DVD, and audiobook overall, Mike?
Quite a gentle pace for me, Al. Not seeing the DVD in all again. As you said, the scope is improved upon in this book from the limited TV budget. Peter Purvis is a very engaging reader. Perhaps gets a little muddled at times, as a few Doctor Who stories do, with a few too many characters. The characterisation of Dodo in particular and some of the women isn't great at all, you know. Really showing the worst of the sort of 60s stereotypical attitudes. So I might mark off a point or so for that. I'd say around about 7.5 for the TV version and 8 together for the novelisation and the audiobook.
I think like you, it has a bit of a slower pace in the audiobook and the book, where it gets pretty quickly on with it in the episode. So I watched the episodes yesterday. The TV episodes work, but the problem is they were trying to do too much for the sort of things they could do at the time, unfortunately, so that lets it down a bit. I will agree that the actual, you know, outlook of women is a bit terrible in the TV episode and the book, so it has to lose slight points for that, I agree. It's just the fact this should be 1966 and it should be things getting, you know, better feminism-wise. You know, unfortunately, you know, it doesn't. You know, the main female character, Dodo, is completely slapped down by Stephen and the Doctor, which is not good. I think the TV episode should get about a 6, and the audiobook will get a 7.5, just because of those little things about feminism, really. I think Peter Purvis's reading is very good, and I think his Doctor voice is fantastic, William Hartnell, but I think the actual content lets the book down a bit, so that's what I'm doing. So, we need to discuss the cover for Doctor Who the Ark. You were saying there's only one this time for it, I suppose.
Yes, a David McAllister for the initial publication. Doctor Who Davison, red-lettered, white trim logo. The Ark underneath in white lettering. A black background with a starfield, a picture of the Earth with the sun rising, or the sun going around it. Hartnell is in a triangle, which is reminiscent of the Five Doctors for me. Blue sky in the background, a monoid's head floating in the air. We can see in this they have a brown sort of mop-top Beatles-style wig with a black face and the one protruding eye, of course. Hartnell's there, just the profile of him, looking sort of quite relaxed, really, in his face. Possibly just under his nose, above his top lip. Looks a little bit wider than it does normally, the way it's drawn, but the eyes are definitely Bill's. He has a deer to one side of his head, and the tiger to the other. Paul Erickson in blue writing, the white and black trimmed target symbol. Quite a decent one, Al. Doesn't tell you a heck of a lot about what's going on. I presume you'd see the word Ark, you'd see the animals, and you'd think, oh, this is the concept. You know, something to do with Noah's Ark. Not the most memorable, but, you know, a good effort.
Yeah, I think the same what you were saying there. It sort of tells you it's definitely about an Ark and it's got an alien, but it sort of doesn't tell you an awful lot. So you probably have to read it to find out more, I suppose. It's like, you know, I think the cover's nice because it sort of says this is what's going to happen, I suppose, but is it really a noticeable cover? I don't know.
Yes, I suppose we should be thankful they moved back into the artwork from the terrible photos in the early to mid-80s.
It's a good thing, and you've seen the artwork better than I have for the new ones. Are they using photo imagery, or is it animated drawing again?
No, it's drawing on they're keeping the sort of cream background to all the novelisations which they've had since the reissues and the 50th anniversary year.
So the new ones have got the same sort of feel, have they? They've got that sort of feel to do things like Rose and...
They all seem to be more of a collage effect, you know. The Rose one has pictures of Eccleston in sort of black and white darker colour, and then you have Rose in colour behind him, and you tend to get, I think, the Bradley Doctor is more sort of black and white than the Capaldi one on the Twice Upon a Time one.
Yeah, it's good to see what they are still sort of keeping to the same outlook. Well, I agree, sometimes the photo imagery works better sometimes. I think I'm like you, I'm a big fan of the drawn ones as well, so I think it's a good compromise, really.
This is Alex Gibbon's Doctor Who News Round.
Hello there, this is Alex, and this is Who's News on the 9th of March. Well, the first thing that's happened this week, which is pretty major, is BBC have announced that they are going to bring all the classic Doctor Who out on Blu-ray. This will also involve upgrades of all the content from video releases and DVD, including lots of new extras and stuff that's sort of been around but hasn't been cleaned up. Also, episodes will have a new 5.1 soundtrack done mainly by Mark Ayres, and also you'll be able to add extra bits to different episodes. The first box set is Tom Baker Season 1, which includes Robot, Ark in Space, Genesis of the Daleks, Santaran Experiment, and Revenge of the Cybermen. So we're talking top quality Tom Baker. On April 21st in United Kingdom and America is National Record Shop Day. This is where independent record shops bring out lots of interesting stuff for people like me who enjoy things on vinyl. This year, Demon Records, part of the BBC, are bringing out two special Doctor Who vinyls. One is City of Death, Tom Baker fantastic episode, and on a gatefold 128-gram silver edition is Tomb of the Cybermen. These are the original music and episodes with narration, so it should be very good if you like your Doctor Who on vinyl. Also from BigFinish.com this week, we have an announcement that the third part of their 40th anniversary Blake 7 series is coming out in April. It's called Crossfire Part 3, and there is a trailer and the artwork on their website. In May, Big Finish are giving Colin Baker's Sixth Doctor a new companion. He seems to finally have got a new male companion after having three very feisty female companions. This will be launched in the main range Big Finish title. In May, the title is called The Lure of the Nomad. His companion is called Matthew Sharp, and he is a space pilot from the future. Should be very interesting, as Colin, it can always be a very interesting doctor when he has somebody good to fight against or rail against. So, it's time to discuss what we've been watching, reading, listening, whatever's been tingling our molecules. And with me, music molecule-wise, it's been today the new Editors album, which is extremely good. Lots of good synths all over the place, like Editors always are, called Violence. And the new David Burns album, so I forgot the title, but it's the out today on Apple Music or on Google Play, wherever you get your downloads from, or you can buy it both on vinyl. Talking Heads guy, in case you wondered who David Burns is, if you didn't know. TV-wise, I, of course, have been watching Jessica Jones on Netflix most of last night, and then there's been lots of sort of bits of drama finishing, like Collateral and Guilty Pleasures, I think, has started up again with things like MasterChef. So, what about you, Mike?
I listened to quite a few movie-based podcasts and things lately. One is the Betamax Video Club, in which they go back to the 80s classics like The Karate Kid, The Cannonball Run, Superman 2, I listened to the other night. It's very enjoyable. If you're a listener to the Smirsch podcast by John Rain on the Bond films, it's a very similar sort of 80s, 90s child humour. Very tongue-in-cheek look at back at these films, which are still thoroughly enjoyable to these days, but as we do with many things as we get older, we pick up more plot holes and we find things to criticise about them, but there's definitely still a love for those classics.
I agree, you know, you sort of look at stuff you like when you're younger and look at the either stand up or they don't stand up, so they sound quite interesting. Podcast wise, I haven't really been, well, Big Finish one, of course, I listen to every Sunday when it comes out, and I see that Mr. Nick Briggs and Ben Cliff have got their own sort of thing on through Nick Briggs' website.
Good. Yeah, I've also returned a little bit to video gaming in the last few months since finally getting a PS4, which I used more or less for smart sort of TV type applications and playing the 4K discs whenever I get that telly al. I've got into Call of Duty World War II. I just really like the narrative storytelling of it. I've never been one for online gaming, haven't really tried it yet. I do like the old-fashioned storylines of these shoot-em-ups, and the way graphics are gone nowadays, the way storytelling has gone, the way they get some brilliant voice actors in, the way motion capture has developed is just still fascinates me.
Yeah, I've been thinking about, even the cycling, I'm quite a big fight game. So I've got a new laptop and I'm thinking about maybe getting a new Tekken 7. That. Well, it's very interesting how motion capturing has gone. So I heard a rumour this week's Oscars, but for next year there's probably going to be an actual category for motion capture work because it's got that good.
Excellent. So what might we be seeing in 5 years' time for the 60th anniversary of Doctor Who? Will it be cheap enough to give us the equivalent of the CGI Peter Cushing from Rogue One by then on a BBC budget?
We never know, the way things are going, because they could, like 10 years ago, they couldn't do proper fire, and now they can do that beauty in CGI and that. So it's a very interesting. What about TV? Have you looked at anything on Netflix or things like that?
Guilty pleasure-wise, well, guilty pleasure, I suppose, for me, is the Lethal Weapon TV show. Now, I was dead against this.
I haven't watched it, because I just thought it couldn't get close to the films. Is it good?
It's just suitably different, but it pays a nice homage to things. I was putting it off for a while, but then I watched the first one and I was pretty hooked. And we're about 5 or 6 episodes in the UK on ITV into the second season now. And you just have to go in thinking, although Danny Glover and Mel Gibson are so wrapped up in these characters, this one is set with them being a similar age, but now you have Damon Wayans as Roger Murtaugh and you have Clayne Crawford as Martin Riggs. And it really sort of delves into the psychology behind Martin Riggs. But the great big set pieces are there. A lot of them are done in CGI nowadays. But at least every few weeks, sometimes every week, you get a huge set piece which you might have seen in the film. Which such the things we remember from those great movies, like they're jumping in the swimming pool from the high building. In the first season, there was a very memorable car chase through a Formula One race that was going on with all the guns blasting. It's very stylishly shot. Great sweeping vistas of LA. It really shows out the HDR, I suppose the 4K, when I get round to seeing it like that, Al. But it's thoroughly recommended for me. It's a bit sort of popcorn telly. You don't have to think too much about the plot. You can usually guess quite early on in the episode who the protagonist is going to be. And I'm quite surprised, in a way, it has stretched out and kept my enjoyment for over a season. But such an engaging cast. A really, just an enjoyable sort of popcorn bit of entertainment telly.
Well, yeah, I know. That's good, I think, sometimes. That's why I watch things like MasterChef, because things can get a little bit heavy drama-wise. I was just thinking, the other thing I've been listening to this week is the rather good, I think it's been on every day on Radio 4, it's probably on the iPad now, sort of like a prequel, I don't know if you've ever seen it, the Waking the Dead. It's like had nearly the whole cast back, and it was like a 5-day sort of murder thing, which is very good. It's on the iPlayer now, and it'd be worth a listen. Yeah, have you tried? I really love it now. Gotham.
No, I haven't got into it yet, Al, but it will be on the list. There's so much TV to choose from these days, isn't it? Streaming services and the regular channels.
Yeah, there's an awful lot. You do sort of get semi-swamped. You have to, dive into the big Netflix thing. That's why I think with time and that's why the ones where you can just watch the whole thing work better than the week by week, I think, on Netflix. But it's just really good the way they're going with the sort of whole bad legacy in Gotham, the TV series. It's been done very well, I think, and it just gets better and better by the seasons, I think.
I am looking forward to released, I think, this time next week. I went to the gig itself in Birmingham, England last year. Ricky Gervais' Humanity World Tour is coming out as the Netflix special next week.
Oh, is it on? I'm going to have to watch that. Is that on there, is it?
Yes, and interesting what you were saying about the amount of TV being produced now, Al, because he was on a Absolute Radio Breakfast show in the UK this week, Ricky being interviewed. And he said, whereas 5 years ago, the likes of him and other stand-ups such as Jerry Seinfeld would be looking at the Holy Grail being the HBO special. But he said Netflix have totally changed the game now, and that's what you really look for.
Yeah, well, the Seinfeld things on Netflix are he's so still on ball, Seinfeld, and they are really good. I've had watched those on there. Do we, the way content is these days, it's there. You watch it, you don't really consider it as much. It has to be really good to sort of give you a lasting feel, I think.
Got to mention the 40th anniversary yesterday of the first radio broadcast, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I did have a re-listen to the first season again last week. Caught the last 50 minutes of the updated version, which hasn't gone down that well on social media, but with many of the original cast, well, we know what social media's like, Al, but I didn't enjoy what I heard of it, but I'm trying to do them chronologically now, so I'll get through the next 4 before
Well, we've got them running. They're all on Audible because I'm going to buy to get them. I actually don't own them on CD, so I'm going to get them per month by Audible credits, so I've got to date. But I listened to it last night, and I thought it was as funny as ever. It sounded fantastic on a 5.1 system. It was brilliant. I didn't think there was much of a problem with it. Well, why has it gone down badly on social networking?
Probably just the old fanboy thing of it not totally being Douglas Adams, which unfortunately it can't be nowadays, but Ian Colfer, wasn't it, has adapted it. But we also had one of the original Red Dwarf team, was it Rob Grant, also involved in this new series?
I believe so, because it's done from the Owen Colford book, which is actually a very good book. It's not a bad fist or a hitchhiker book. I've read it, and it's good. But I think with these extra bits, what they've taken from Douglas Adams' library, I think it's really good. And I really like the way obviously, I bet people moan about it not being the original bit of music because it's a redate of the music in 5.1. And I think it sounded really good. I really enjoyed it, so I don't know why people are moaning. And I think, you know, the SFX magazine gave it a really good review when they spoke to them.
Yes, I'm very tempted to go back to the TV show version now as well. I've not seen that for a number of years.
No, no, I think that is the best one. Well, I quite enjoyed it. I know people didn't like it at the time. Well, I quite enjoyed the film with Martin Freeman as Arthur Dent with all the music done by Divine Comedy. I thought that was a really good film. It's one of those really awkward books to film or make because it's so sort of ahead of its time. You sort of don't know what to do with it.
Strange, isn't it, how we reassess films after time? I think when The League of Gentlemen returned for the new Christmas episodes a few months ago, I went back and watched the Apocalypse film, which I hated at the time, but I quite enjoyed it on a rewatch.
It gets beyond, I was like you, I hated it at the time. I think it needed a bit of a breather. I think because we had all the League hype around the time. Oh, it's The League of Gentlemen, they're going to make the best comedy film ever, and it wasn't, unfortunately. And it's nice. It is a lot better than it was in the first one, I'd agree.
Excellent, Al. Excellent. So, anything major-wise you are really looking forward to now, apart from the obvious certain TV show returning in October? Anything you're looking forward to a little bit sooner than that?
In the Who world?
Or just anywhere, really?
In the Who world or in general?
Oh, say one for both, Al. We'll say one from both.
Right, Who world, I'm looking forward to the Tom Baker Blu-ray box set because it's just going to be epic. It's got all the best Tom Baker episodes. And yes, I know a lot of people are moaning like hell about them using the new logo and how it should have been the Tom Baker logo and it doesn't work. Well, I really love the new bright logo. And I know a lot of people going, oh, I've already shelled out for the DVDs and I've bought the separate Blu-rays and la-di-da-da. But this one will be worth it because you just think these guys have somehow managed to take the really scratchy footage and put it into nearly 4K quality. Now, you will be blinded. You will be blown away, trust me. And I will be even happier because it hasn't been confirmed if they get audio description for every episode. Well, that hasn't been confirmed, but I will be quite happy with the audio description menus you get on all Doctor Who DVDs and Blu-rays. So that's my thing I'm looking forward to. It comes out in June. If you haven't pre-ordered it, do, because it's got a limited special artwork cover, I think, at the moment on Amazon.
Yes, and outside Doctor Who?
Outside Doctor Who, well, I'm not busy with my masters. Probably I'm looking forward to the final book by Nikki French, which is sort of going to sort of put everything together in June. That's out. It's called The Day of the Dead. It's her Frida Kline character, sort of what's been going on for like 10 years now, like a different day per book, basically. And they're well worth anything by Nikki French is well worth a listen on Audible and on book form, so it's well worth a listen. Or I will probably sneak in also that Ben Aronovitz has got a new book out. Well, that's not until November, so I'll have to wait for that.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to the Ready Player One movie, Steven Spielberg directing the great homage to 80s and 90s pop culture and noughties.
Yeah, that is also on my list. It looks really good. And it's going to be one of those films you'll probably have to watch twice because there will be so many Spielberg references.
There's already thousands of YouTube videos with breakdowns of the trailer and all the characters you see in the trailer, sort of Chucky, the horror film character. You get the DeLorean car, you get the Iron Giant, you get the teams of soldiers from Halo.
Well, they there as well. I didn't notice the Halo. It's a bit naughty because it's going to be a really good film, but it is Warner Brothers trying to sell as many of their products as possible, really.
Absolutely, and borrowing quite a few other people's thanks to the book, of course.
Yeah, it looks really good. It's got that sort of Matrix feel to it. I think it's going to be that sort of quality films. I think it's out soon, isn't it?
But I do fear it might be disappointing when you actually see it. I'm worried about the amount of hype I'm putting into this.
Well, yeah, I did feel like that from the sort of hype that's on YouTube. You said there are so many theory videos and videos that are broken down. It's like, wow, there's a DeLorean, there's this, there's that. And I just think you might go and go, was this worth the whole preset? I felt a little bit like I Love It Now with Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Everybody went, oh, it's like Mario, it's like this, it's a real gamer's film. And I Love It Now, but I was a bit, no, this doesn't do anything when I first saw it.
I guess, you know, Spielberg is the man to attempt it, but I spoke about this with a friend earlier. When was his last great family sort of film?
BFG.
Of course. That was Spielberg, wasn't it? Of course.
That was Spielberg.
We'd forgotten about that. I did enjoy that.
BFG or any of the original, before you get the Kingdom Skull, Indiana Jones.
Although I kind of like Crystal Skull, though. I tolerate it.
It's one of those that has grown on me. It was not the greatest when I saw it at the cinema, and then I've seen it like 3 or 4 times since when they do like over Christmas, the binge of all of them, and I quite like it now.
But we were thinking back to like AI was quite a disappointment from him, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, I think that wasn't really his fault because it was like a half and half film, wasn't it? It was the first half was Stanley Kubrick before he died, and then Spielberg was sort of put on to finish it, basically.
Yeah, two directors you wouldn't necessarily see in any other circumstance having their work joined together.
I don't know. You think there's no way Kubrick and Spielberg would work, so that's maybe why it slightly jars AI. Well, I think it's one of those films on this film I really do enjoy, actually, before we get Spielberg sort of into political with other great things like Nuremberg and Schindler's List and The Post, which I still haven't seen what everybody raves about.
Yeah, Munich's a great film as well.
Oh, I really like Munich. That's really good. Good. Daniel Craig's brilliant in that.
Okay, Al, so we'll move on to next week. Going to jump ahead to the Fifth Doctor, weren't we?
I believe so, because we were sort of scratching our heads here going, what is available also in book and audio form? I think we finally decided on Black Orchid, didn't we?
Yeah, one of my favourites. One of the very first ones I remember watching as a child back in 82, or aged around 4 or 5 I was when it was first broadcast. So looking forward to hearing that audiobook.
Who's reading the audiobook?
Oh, one of the actors who appears as one of the characters in it. I can't remember his name.
Oh, right, yeah, that'll be good then. So who's written the audiobook? I mean, the book.
I think it's Terence Dudley.
Terence Dudley, well, that'll be interesting.
So, yeah, also did K-9 and Company, of course.
He did indeed, which is, you know, not people's favourite, but people seem to like it now, I think, again.
So thanks for listening, folks. We'll see you next time.
We will indeed. Have fun.
Next time, Doctor Who Target Files, we'll be discussing Black Orchid, written by Terence Dudley, and audiobook performed by Michael Cochrane. You can contact Doctor Who Target Files on Twitter at @DWTargetFiles handle, or search Facebook for our podcast page, Doctor Who Target Files, and leave us a message. Thanks for listening. Doctor Who Target Files, the ARC review, featured Alexander Gibbons and Michael Winks. I Am the Doctor, composed originally by Murray Gold. Version for the podcast by Vale Mystery, VAYLE Mystery. Please do check out their channel on YouTube. News Round, opening and closing themes, composed originally by Ted Heath and his orchestra, and by John Baker. Doctor Who Target Files, the ARC review, was recorded in Exeter, Devon, England, and Swansea, Wales, UK, during March 2018.